This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of March, and this was the week of stay-at-home orders. California is under a statewide order for people to stay at home. New York ordered non-essential businesses to close and people to stay at home as much as possible. These provisions will be enforced. These are not helpful hints, said New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. The federal government has issued voluntary guidelines urging people not to gather in groups larger than 10. But beyond New York and California, lots of states and localities have their own mandatory rules aimed at sharply reducing social contacts and therefore the spread of the novel coronavirus. This isn't about flattening the curve so much as breaking it. The outbreak needs to be stopped before it spreads through the mass population, because at any pace, that is likely to overwhelm the capacity of the American medical system with patients in severe respiratory distress. At the White House press briefings, the tone has shifted sharply. Less time, not zero time, is being spent on the president's grievances about his critics. President Trump, who said on January 22nd he was not at all worried about a pandemic, said on March 17 that he's felt this was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Dr. Kavita Patel joins us now. Kavita is a primary care internist, a health policy researcher, and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She was a health policy advisor in the Obama administration. Hi, Kavita.
Hi there.
Can you tell us what the outlook is for this in our hospitals? We've been seeing all these concerning reports. Do they have the equipment and the staffing that they need? Do they have enough masks and gowns? I mean, the president was asked about this week, and he basically said, that's governor's job. We're not a shipping clerk. Go ask them. How ready are the hospitals?
The hospitals are doing their level best to try to be prepared. But honestly, Josh, these are absolutely unprecedented times where even having almost all hospitals I know of, large and small, have some sort of preparedness, pandemic or otherwise disaster preparedness manual. But there's nothing like this in any manual that I've seen in order to tell people, look, we may have to convert our entire hospitals into coronavirus wards that have respiratory isolation that require these incredibly cumbersome changes of your gowns and masks. Oh, and by the way, you don't have enough of those masks and gowns to change in to keep yourself healthy with the standards that we would recommend. So they are, especially in the hot spots, the coasts, California and New York, and in between Chicago, et cetera, people are doing their best, but they're really looking to guidance from peers, private sector, and where they can, the federal government. But the state is actually taking the lead in many of these instances, and the states are very understaffed and under-resourced to provide the type of assistance that hospitals need.
Rich, I'm wondering what you make of the president's comments on this topic this week. I mean, you know, you wrote some about, you know, the president's nationalism is not shining through here in the way that you would expect it to, or that it ought to in a crisis like this. It seems weird for him to be basically saying, you know, not my job, not my problem about some aspects of this, because it's a crisis and it's everybody's problem, but it's sort of especially the federal government's problem.
Yeah, and it's clear that these shortages exist, and you have government officials denying that they exist. And it makes no sense to me that the president one day would invoke this latest emergency declaration that would allow the emergency manufacturer of this stuff, and then the next day say, well, we're not actually doing that until things get bad. Well, I mean, most of the country is shut down. How bad does it have to get before we do this? But one question I had for Kavita is, we've had all these, she referred to hospitals having all these plans, and we're all reading about these government reports over the years that had these alarming scenarios on what would happen if a pandemic reached our shores. So did no one really stockpile anything? You would think, you know, at the least you would realize you need protective masks at some sort of mass. Now, the military has a stockpile, which it's going to feed into the civilian system, which I assume will help somewhere along the line here. But I'm just wondering why there wasn't more of a strategic reserve of this stuff.
Sure, it's a great question. And when I participated in the H1N1 planning in the White House, that's absolutely kind of the conversation we had around the table. And that's why we have what's called the Strategic National Stockpile. To that point, that there is actually a lot of classification of security around what exactly the numbers are. But that stockpile was meant for one type of scenario. Just as an aside, the three scenarios that most of the country had been planning for was either a cyber attack, a pandemic attack, or a direct military attack. And you can almost see where there's aspects of all three in the coronavirus. Each hospital, just as an actual building and kind of a functional unit, also has kind of a backup, to your point, of reserves. But really, the actual mass kind of force with which we have this virus coming at us in numbers and in just certain places, overwhelming emergency rooms and systems, was not something that anybody could really anticipate. So that's where we have a gap. And the Strategic National Stockpile, by the way, as Josh mentioned, kind of this timeline, I mean, recall that it has taken this long for the federal government to declare a federal emergency. If we had moved that up earlier, that would have mobilized not just our defense resources, but some of that strategic national stockpile, which is, I think, what you're referring to, as well as the ability for the private sector to scale some of the production and do what they need to do in order to actually deliver on these supplies.
We're getting a lot of mixed messaging on who needs to be especially concerned about this virus. I think at first it was sort of widely said, and perhaps this was somewhat jocular, but not completely, that, you know, young people are immune. This is something older people need to worry about. We heard about high school students calling it the boomer remover, particularly callous. But there's been quite a bit of writing now that, you know, there are younger people being hospitalized in critical condition, you know, so as we get ready to face this, and people are making decisions when they're not feeling well about whether they need to go to a hospital or not, what should we make of these conflicting reports, and who should really head to the hospital when they're not feeling well?
Great question. And here's just a little of the context. The World Health Organization, along with the CDC, basically released on American patients that approximately 40% of hospitalized patients were somewhere between the ages of 20 and 54. To your point, kind of under that demographic that we had largely been quoting based off of data from China, that showed that the majority of hospitalizations or serious illness were really in patients older than 50. So you're absolutely right to say that it feels like we're getting conflicting information. And from a science perspective, it's hard to know whether this is really a function of the fact that in the American hospital systems, we actually do a pretty good job of being aggressive once someone comes in the doors. And we are trying to get this earlier when possible and recognize it. Or is it also something about the virus that's changing, and the people we thought were able to pass this without having symptoms, children, are now showing symptoms? It's not clear. And what I would say, just as a practical matter of advice to any listener, is that now we do have a lot more of this quote-unquote telemedicine capacity. You're seeing almost every physician and every insurance company allowing for these visits much more liberally than they had before, where there were restrictions. I would say do not hesitate to reach out to a health professional. Do not go to an emergency room unless you're actually feeling like you are truly ill, not able to breathe, and that you feel like you really do need to have a doctor or a nurse physically evaluate you. And I would highly encourage, people have been saying, well, children aren't going to get this. And we know, even from China, that that's not true. We know that children have a lower death rate, but children do get this illness. So just as a practical matter, if you have a fever, whether you're a child or an adult, and you might ask, what's a fever? Most of us in the medical profession would constitute a fever for an adult at least at 100.5. And then some pediatricians would say anywhere as, you know, low as 99.5, but 100.5 or higher. And if all you have is a fever and nothing else, still call a health professional and monitor yourself. And then practically speaking, if you're starting to get symptoms of any kind and you've had a known contact, until you can actually get to a health professional, either by telephone or person, strongly encourage you to practice what I would call self-isolation if you're in a household. And that means having one bathroom or wiping down surfaces that you share with others, and that adage that we've been using, frequent hand washing.
Kavita, the president on Thursday spoke about some ongoing drug trials, and the FDA commissioner also spoke at the White House daily briefing on coronavirus. And the president was painting this as really promising, some not just about, you know, a vaccine that could be quite a ways off, but some existing drugs that are already used for the treatment of other conditions. There are trials looking at whether those can be effective against the coronavirus. Can you give us a sense, how promising are those trials? And if some of those treatments are effective, how long would it take for them to be widely available for treatment in the United States?
Sure. And just to level set, the president spoke, I think, and here's another example where I think, unfortunately, it's caused a bit of confusion because he referenced not just some of the new trials that are promising in both the vaccine front as well as a potential treatment front, but he also made a reference to some older drugs that have been around for decades, one of which, for example, is used for malaria. Unfortunately, that's all anecdotal. The only existing trials that are in place, two leading pharmaceutical manufacturers, Gilead and Regeneron, have trials in place for a potential treatment. And it's an antibody-mediated treatment. That means that it's taking kind of, you know, immunity-based cells and actually targeting a mechanism that we believe is what's causing this devastating illness and coronavirus. And they are, because of the work for these exact same molecules in Ebola, they are able to actually kind of go through this trial process a little bit faster, not because they're shortcutting things, but they are able to get us into what we're calling phase 2 and 3 clinical trials. And there should be early clinical readouts in about 3 months, potentially a little longer. So that does give me some silver lining. Again, that is a far cry from saying, yes, all of America has access to a treatment, but we think that these could be potential opportunities for the most seriously ill. So I can't stress that enough. This is not going to be something, you know, that we can just go and get and call in and pick up at our local pharmacy. This is really going to be reserved for seriously ill patients. The vaccine, as you may have heard, and Dr. Fauci has mentioned this from the NIH, those are ongoing as well. And the vaccine is a different proposition because that is something that you want to give to everybody. So the safety standards are incredibly rigorous, but they're still trying to speed those up. I would say at earliest, we've got probably 12 months until we see something like that, which is why everybody is taking these shelter-in-place, self-quarantine measures, hand-washing, social distancing very seriously.
It seems even if we get some antivirals that just limit hospital stays or limit mortality, it'll take a little bit of the edge off and perhaps allow a relaxation of these kind of closures and shutdowns, which are going to have an enormous human cost themselves. So I'm curious, Kavita, what you think of also another model, which a lot of people have talked about, which is South Korea, in which obviously very early on the testing has done massive testing and has been able basically to rifle shot the social controls on individuals who are sick or might be sick. I mean, it's an incredible system where people can track you if you're sick on their phones and see where you are and avoid a contact with you, which is obviously an incredibly intrusive thing, but maybe less damaging to society than shutting down entire states. But how obviously we should have been on the stick faster on testing, but how replicable is that model given South Korea, you know, much smaller society, and a lot of the initial problem stemmed from one outbreak surrounding this church?
Right. And I think you're bringing up kind of a couple of themes, just testing in general, which I think everybody, including, by the way, health professionals have been saying, you know, why is it that when I order a test, it might take 3 to 4 days? First of all, it's hard to get them. If you can get them, it can take several days to turn around. And you're absolutely correct that in South Korea, smaller population. Interestingly enough, I would say a much more coordinated health infrastructure. And that can we can have longer discussions about, you know, government kind of responsibility in healthcare, always a good political topic. But having said that, they did take this both from an infrastructure perspective and from just a capacity building in general around public health more seriously. And the widespread testing absolutely is something, whether it's drive-through or even a concept that we're trying now to think about more seriously in the United States around self-testing. To your point, could we actually, because we just can't all get into a hospital or doctor's office, and it's not what we want doctors to be doing. So I do think that there is so much that we are learning. However, I worry that we just have been behind. And so we are catching up. We are using, you know, it feels like finally the White House has heard the message and you're seeing what I would say is a change in tone. Unfortunately, these things are just not turnkey. You have the major companies that do testing, LabCorp, Quest, others, who are literally working 24/7, but are just backlogged in processing these samples. And then you have internal hospitals, everything from Stanford to Mayo and others, that have in-house testing, and they are trying to ramp up. But remember, this is a supply chain, and it can often be the least costly goods in that supply chain that are the barriers. For example, the chemical reagent that even an internal hospital would use to run a test is actually ironically sourced out of France or Italy. And so if you can't get that, or you don't have enough of those nasal swabs that you keep seeing on television for testing, which is actually happening, then that will limit all the downstream. And so that's where, again, the quantity that we have is unlike South Korea, and the impact, as well as the fact that we do not have kind of a federated capacity surveillance mechanism. With 2020 technology, you would think that I should be able to say, I've got 500 tests that aren't being used in this part of the state of California. Let me get those over to this other part that's going through a hot spot. We simply just don't have that infrastructure. And that's one of the, sadly, I think we're going to have a lot of after lesson kind of action items, you know, and kind of 9/11 commission style recommendations. And that'll be one of the big lessons.
Kavita, can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in your practice, and maybe if that tells you something about what the outlook is for this? How are we going to get through this? Do you have a sense of, you know, how long we're going to be under the sort of really significant restrictions that we're under now? Are we going to get a handle on this such that we don't have a collapse of the style that we've seen in Northern Italy? What's the prognosis for us?
Sure. And really, not just what I see myself, but also, you know, now has never been a more important time to have this connectedness amongst all of us in society, but especially a lot of my medical colleagues. So just day-to-day practically, what I'm seeing and hearing are a lot of confusion, questions. It's starting to escalate now, the tone with which people are demanding tests. So in the DC kind of region, we've got, you know, we are standing up drive-through testing or access to some of the labs that I mentioned, but there is still some delays in the turnaround time. There's also a lot of questions, as you've brought up, about whether children can get this. And before, we thought that children that had colds, we didn't have to worry about, and now people are concerned. And then there's also the safety part on healthcare workers. Every clinic I know has been trying to discourage, you know, just regular physicals or wellness visits or elect, and nobody is doing, you know, really any quote elective procedures, things that you don't have to have today. So I think that the kind of way that we're trying to learn, again, everything is about learning from our colleagues. Italy, and remember, Italy itself had, the north and south of Italy are quite different populations, as well as infrastructure and healthcare. So we're seeing actually different kind of response needs from parts of their country. And that's actually absolutely true in the United States. But we are learning that the biggest and most important thing is to have this hospital preparedness. On the ambulatory clinic side or outpatient side, it's really about how to help triage. And that means really thinking through not just who needs testing, but who needs to be hospitalized early. Because just from a medical standpoint, the clinical presentation that people are coming in with, and why you're hearing so many people talk about the need for ventilators, people come in profoundly hypoxemic. And all that means is that the blood oxygen saturation is incredibly low. And so they really have to be intubated and ventilated and have kind of, quote, mechanical assistance quickly. So knowing that, we now know that that's what we are trying to prepare for. And we're also having, you know, we're talking internally in the medical community about waves. This first wave is the surge response. The second wave is going to be kind of the need to convert, you know, you're hearing people talk about converting churches to hospitals or schools to hospitals. The third wave is going to be capacity to relieve the workers in the first and second wave, not just because a lot of them are getting sick, but if we are going to be in this for several months, in some, you know, a roller coaster of sorts in some form, we are going to need to have planning for months from now, not just days from now.
Kavita Patel is a primary care internist, a health policy researcher, and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Kavita, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk about coronavirus's impact on the economy and the workforce. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. Extreme measures to stop the coronavirus are sure to be a huge blow to the economy. In fact, they're already a huge blow to the economy. Unemployment claim statistics are usually reported a week after the fact, but some states have been reporting their numbers every day as the claims come in. And if you add up the available data, it looks like this week there may be more than 2.2 million initial claims for unemployment benefits from people who have lost their jobs. That's more than three times the previous record. It's unprecedented to shut down so much of the economy at once, and to be clear, I believe it is necessary for now, but the effects on people and on businesses are going to be huge, and they're going to require a huge government response, the terms of which Congress is currently debating. To discuss that, we're joined now by Connor Doherty. Connor is a California-based economics reporter at the New York Times, and his new book is called Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Hi, Connor.
Hey, Josh. How are you?
Well, not too bad under the circumstances. The social restrictions have gotten gradually more severe throughout California, culminating on Thursday in Governor Gavin Newsom issuing a stay-at-home order that applies to the whole state, telling people they can't go to work unless they work in certain essential functions. What have you been finding as you look at what this is doing to businesses and to workers?
Well, for starters, living in the Bay Area, I've been living it. I went to a coffee shop the other morning and everyone was queued outside about 6 feet apart. Even though the coffee shop inside was empty, there was a line all the way down the block. When I go to the supermarket, they hand out latex gloves and will only let a certain number of people into the supermarket at a time. I mean, it's a full shutdown. I was telling someone the other day, I covered the dot-com bust, some of the Enron recession stuff, the accounting scandals, and then I covered extensively the Great Recession when I was at the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things you always see, and I'm sure you've lived this yourself, when there's a big market disruption or something like this, editors always say to you, hey, can you call some real businesses and see what the impact on them is? And the editors, of course, always disappointed because it really usually takes a couple weeks or a couple months to really start to see the impact show up. That did not happen here. Within like seriously hours of the stock market disruptions and people kind of recognizing that this was something awful, I called businesses. They were already laying people off, cutting hours, shutting down. A coffee shop down the street from me just put up a sign and said, we're out. We're not even going to try to make it through this thing. We're going out of business for good. People are like, I have zero income now. Not my income is cut in half. It's, I have nothing now. You know, I've never seen anything ever ripple so fast through the real economy. And so I think what's interesting is if you think about 2008, it was a banking crisis it was a financial crisis that had huge impact on the real economy. This is like a total collapse of the real economy that is now going to threaten to become a financial crisis. So I don't know if we have a playbook for that, but I guess we're going to develop it as we go.
Liz, that's an alarming description there. What do you think the federal government needs to be focusing on right now to address that?
I don't know if in the history of the United States we've ever had a similar situation in terms of how quickly and how severely the ramifications of a situation have taken hold on the economy. I do think that, you know, both parties, quite surprisingly, seem to be recognizing that there are several, you know, sort of immediate measures that they could enact to at least ease things up. Relieving debt, for example, canceling student debt, which is an enormous source of debt, makes a lot of sense if there are going to be lots of people out of work and struggling even to pay for basic essentials. I think sort of cash transfers as part of a stimulus make quite a bit of sense. And different amounts have gone back and forth. And of course, I tend to favor the more generous ones. But I think that's thinking along the right lines at the very least. And then I think, you know, handling rent and foreclosure. Trump has made statements about this. I would say a pretty comprehensive response on that front is necessary and vital because we need people to be in their dwellings. So they need access to dwellings.
Rich, as Liz notes, there's been a bipartisan consensus that some sort of large response is needed, although the terms of that have been a matter of a lot of debate. And then also, I feel like, and we're seeing this in the banking industry too, that people are not quite keeping up with the pace at which this is getting worse. I mean, you saw like Goldman Sachs issued on March 5th a new forecast saying this is going to be quite bad. We think growth for the year is going to be down to 1.2%. Then a week later, they revised it again and said 0.4%. Then they revised it again on Friday. And it was minus almost 4%. And so you see that flow up to Washington. You saw Mitt Romney a few days ago propose that every American adult should be sent a $1,000 check, which sounded like a really large number a few days ago. It's not clear to me that that number is actually that large in comparison to the economic disaster that we're facing. And then now you have Senate Republicans bogged down. The official Senate Republican proposal came out actually proposing to send a smaller check to the poorest households than middle-income households would get. And that's gotten a lot of pushback even within the Republican conference, Mitt Romney and Josh Hawley saying that's a bad idea, you can't send less to poorer people. But it still feels to me like the scale of the solutions being discussed in Washington hasn't caught up with the scale of the crisis.
Yeah, I had the same experience with the economic numbers. I was talking to a former Trump economic guy on Monday or Tuesday morning, and he's like, I think the quarterly GDP number is going to be minus 10. I'm like, minus 10? And then this morning I was reading some outfit or bank, I don't know which one, was saying it could be minus 20. So this is a self-inflicted depression. And I think the Federal Reserve and the federal government are just going to have to fire liquidity and cash with bazookas, you know, in both arms. And I expect, you know, there are differences between the Senate and House versions of this latest stimulus, but I think we'll probably get both and all of the above. I think the urgency of it, the scale of it, will mean this just thing. Both parties basically get a version of what they want, and the number goes much higher. And as you said, with the Romney proposal, we're in an environment where just every 12 hours, something that seemed extreme is accepted, and we're on to the next extreme thing. So first, the House version, I think, was $850 billion, which sounded like a lot. And then I guess the Senate version, what is it, like $1.2 trillion? You know, we might be up to $2 trillion by early next week when this thing probably passes.
Connor, what can those bazookas look like that Rich is saying, you know, to fire liquidity into the economy? Because I think about what Liz is saying there, that, you know, people need relief from various obligations that they're not going to be able to pay with so much of the economy shut down, relief from rents, relief from mortgage payments, that sort of thing. And I think that's right. But it feels to me like it sets up this cascade, right? Like, you know, you give people relief from rents, which is something that they're doing in France. Then can your landlord pay his mortgage? And maybe your landlord needs relief from his mortgage payments. But then what does that do to bondholders who are expecting those payments? If, you know, if the mortgage-backed securities can't be paid, then what sort of cascade can that cause through the financial system? I mean, that seems like where you start getting back to some of the stuff in 08. It feels like this cascades all the way up and the federal government has to be the ultimate payer for a lot of these things to keep the system running. But it feels to me like there's complicated moving parts and it may be difficult to get that right.
100%. I mean, I don't think any of us can mentally game this out too far. It's almost like I feel like we're in some strange science experiment where we're not even, where we're thinking about, you know, I don't know, black holes or something. You know, I mean, it just feels like we're not thinking about regular life as we know it. So as Elizabeth said, so in California, we've had a number of, it's as if everybody is fighting everyone to come up with a new foreclosure and eviction restriction. We've had multiple city ones. Then we had several legislators propose one. Then we had Gavin Newsom proposed one. Then it turned out Gavin's was different. And this, anyway, everyone is fighting everyone, it seems like, to come up with a new eviction and foreclosure rule. And obviously the best way to handle that would be to have some kind of large state or federal rule so that there was not so much confusion about what was even happening. But as you say, I talked to a landlord the other day, a guy who, a big-ish landlord, he owns 1,000, he runs a company that owns 1,000 multifamily units across California. And he was saying to me, I mean, we might get like half the rent, if that, next month. He said, well, what happens if like nobody pays their rent? Not just because of an eviction moratorium, but just because they can't. He was like, I don't know what happens. And he pays all the utility bills, the property taxes, the to say nothing of income taxes and all these other things. It seems to me like the only way intellectually you could keep the economy even somewhat normal is to give everyone money and then just tell them to go about their normal life the normal way. But of course, the cost of that is like whatever, you know, $17 trillion over a year or something. I don't know. It's something. It's in the realm of multiple trillions of dollars. And I don't know how we have first off, I don't even know that we have the capacity for that. But beyond that, I don't even know that we have like a construct in our mind for, you know, how you would even go about that.
We talked about the Romney proposal and sending $1,000 to people being radical. But how long is that going to be good for anyone? You know, you lost your job, you lost your livelihood. Here's $1,000 check. You know, how long does that last? And that's why I just think this total shutdown, it's unsustainable. And the Wall Street Journal has an editorial out saying, you know, we can only do this for, you know, another week, which it seems too extreme, but we can't do this till June. We can't do this till July, which is why all the kind of rifle shot extreme measures we could do, having the military, you know, build makeshift hospitals, you know, nationalizing the protective mask industry, if that would help. I'm in favor of doing all of those because what we're doing at the moment is really the most extreme thing you could do. Shut down your society and cause an enormous harm to untold millions of people. And, you know, sustainable in the short term, but it can't, the medium term, we're just not going to be able to do this.
I mean, the thing though is, Rich, we're going to have to do this for more than a week. And I share your concern about the sustainability. And I think that's why it's so important. And there's been a lot written about this over the last week or so about other, you know, South Korea style measures, what we need to do to ramp up to be able to do things other than shutdowns to suppress this over the period of many months that we're going to need to be suppressing it. But, you know, it's going to take more than a week. Italy's been under lockdown for more than a week. So I think it is clearly sustainable for at least that period. But I think, you know, as we've been talking about these fiscal responses, I mean, it's important for, you know, for the macro economy so that that when we get past this epidemic, that the economy will be able to grow again, people will have money to spend. It's important for people's livelihoods. I think there hasn't been enough focus on how important the fiscal response is for ensuring that the epidemiological response works, which is to say, I'm worried about people complying with these stay-home orders if they're running out of money. There's going to be a lot of, you know, public pressure that people say, you know, you have destroyed my livelihood. I need to be able to support myself. I don't have money. I think that interferes with compliance. And frankly, I'm eventually concerned about civil unrest. if we have to impose these measures for a long time. And so I think that, you know, there are a number of things that the government needs to be doing to get ahead of that, including preparing for other viral suppression measures. But I think one of those things is money, making sure that to the extent that we can, people are able to support themselves through this crisis. And, you know, the federal government still borrows very cheaply. And so the ability of the federal government to borrow to support individuals who are greatly harmed by this is extensive, and I think it needs to be drawn on.
Just a quick point on that, Josh. I don't think we can predict how the mood might shift on this. So now, you know, people are walking on a boardwalk in San Francisco, and CNN is outraged by it, you know, for 20 minutes. And maybe a month from now, you know, that the coffee shop out in San Francisco says, you know what, just come in, sit down, and have a cappuccino. And everyone's celebrating that if it's felt as though these shutdowns have had such a drastic effect and everyone's sick of them. So it's hard to predict where the mood might be weeks from now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's difficult to get a good sense of how morale is going to change. And, you know, as we can see by the explosion of this pandemic, there's always new things happening in the world of medicine that could make a difference for us. I know that, you know, we're being cautioned against expecting too much in the way of medical interventions that could make a big difference. I have some hopes for morale and for the economy. I mean, a World War II style mobilization, you know, which has been bandied about with Ford and General Motors and other big manufacturers with capacity in the United States making ventilators and other life-saving medical equipment, you know, potentially could have the same effect as ramping up a war economy. And I think that would also be good for morale. I just always thought that if we were having a huge mobilization that relied on a lot of social solidarity and we were even being offered the treat of nationalizing quite a few industries, I would be happier about it.
Connor, can we talk a little bit about the impact on state and local governments here? Because, I mean, one of the financial pressures that's facing businesses is, you know, sales tax payments are due. People, individuals will have tax obligations to state and local governments that they have difficulty meeting. But those state and local governments face their own economic difficulties right now. We've seen interest rates spike in the municipal bond market. You're seeing transit agencies all around the country with ridership way down, but they're not, in a lot of cases, they're not cutting service very much, in part because they need the trains to run kind of empty, because you want people not to be close together on them. Do you have a sense in the Bay Area how officials are thinking about that? Clearly, you know, I mean, here in New York, I'm seeing people throw around numbers that we're going to need a $4 billion bailout of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and that might even be a low number. It feels like that's sort of a sleeper area where this is going to have really significant economic effects.
BART right now is still running normal service, even though they're completely empty. And part of the reason is they need the trains to run, but part of the reason is also they have these labor contracts that guarantee, they essentially can't shut the trains down because they'd have to pay for the whole system anyway. I really hate to sound alarmist because I hope we just somehow find our way through this thing. But not only are they going to run up huge deficits, like you just said, I think they could honestly just like straight up run out of cash within a pretty quick time period. You know, local governments are not the federal government. They do have pretty significant obligations, and they're not running large surpluses. Not only could the state and federal, so the state and local governments see huge declines in property taxes, in sales tax revenues, which is, you know, probably going to zero. They're also, I think they may literally just be telling their workers in a couple weeks, if this continues, like we simply do not even have a bank account with money in it. I mean, obviously that'll vary from city to city. You know, it's funny, the state of California was talking about how they have a pretty significant rainy day fund just a week ago, which of course feels like a year ago now. And I can't even imagine what's happened to that. And it will go away in like a minute, because their decline in revenues on the other side is going to be so drastic. So again, at every level of this, once you start thinking through it, it's hard not to just see, like I said, a total collapse. I mean, 70%, I mean, we all know this, right? 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer purchases. They have, for all intents and purposes, like just stopped. I mean, 40 million people in the fifth largest economy in the world, California, are just inside right now. And, you know, aside from the occasional CNN boardwalk scene or, you know, a couple coffee shops in the Mission District, when I walk around Oakland, which I've been doing a lot to try to maintain my sanity, it's pretty empty. There's a lot of jogging. Maybe jogging shoe sales are up. But other than that, I can't see any activity going on. And I'm already trying to think through, like, I moved to the neighborhood I live in because there's a lot of lovely storefronts. Are every one of those storefronts going to be closed? Because, I mean, most of them are straight up closed right now. And in the few that are considered essential, the restaurants and all that are clearly running a very, I mean, they're trying, right? They're doing takeout, they're doing all this, but you can tell that, I mean, I saw the owner of the little Italian restaurant I go to filling orders himself. So I assume that all of his waiters and everyone else has been laid off or is not there. Again, these are the businesses that fund all of these local governments. So, I mean, you got to imagine that their revenues are going to zero too.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the New York Times on the left, Rich Lowry of National Review on the right, and our special guest, Connor Doherty, economics reporter for the New York Times. We'll be back to talk about what a stay-at-home order means if you don't have a home. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts. Or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And Connor Doherty, economics reporter at the New York Times, is our special guest. The whole state of California is now under an order to stay home. There are a list of exceptions. You can go to the grocery store, you can go to work if you do certain essential functions. But broadly, most Californians are supposed to stay in their homes most of the time to avoid contact with other people. Orders with similar or somewhat less severity have been issued in many other jurisdictions around the United States. But what does a stay-at-home order mean if you don't have a home? California famously had a homelessness crisis before it had the coronavirus crisis. And there are a lot of concerns about what this crisis will mean for the vulnerable homeless population. Connor, what is being done about that?
It's crazy. I was saying to someone the other day, just a week or two ago, we were talking about how it might take a decade to solve the homeless problem, if we'll ever really solve it. This is just so intractable. They're basically going to try to solve it in like 2 weeks now. They're buying hotel rooms. They're bringing in trailers, finding places for people to be inside. By the way, you know, among the deaths in California, one of the first ones was a homeless person. So that's going to almost certainly continue. It's finding places for people in trailers, in gyms, in, like I said, buying hotels. The state is already doing that. I can only imagine what the war room in Gavin Newsom's office looks like right now. You guys are talking about nationalizing of industries, and I know a modular home builder, and he's building homeless housing and had been, you know, he builds homeless housing in a factory. And he was saying that suddenly they're saying, like, what can you do to run double shifts, triple shifts, and sort of just create housing at a scale we've never quite seen?
My main question about all of the ramping up that's happening in terms of resolving the housing crisis, you know, what the left has always said about the housing crisis is just give people homes, just give people dwellings, put them in houses, housing first. This is sort of a left rallying cry before all of these, you know, sort of smaller incremental measures, rent assistance, rent control, et cetera, which left is not against. They just don't consider it equal to the problem. So now what I'm wondering is, since we're just sort of going ahead and doing that, and I have this same question about the industries that are being, potentially nationalized and the assistance that's coming out, what happens when the pandemic passes? Presumably this will be at some point behind us. China is now, I think, on a second or third day of not reporting any new cases in Wuhan, the original source of the outbreak. And ideally, we could also get to a point where we're not having any new cases, where we're ready to start to look at getting back to life as we once knew it. But what will that look like? And what will we do with the people who we've put into housing and the industries that we have taken over and the assistance people have become accustomed to. I wonder if this is sort of a backdoor way for, you know, certain left policies to become permanent, and if we should be cautiously optimistic about that, or if that's, you know, not the case whatsoever, and there will be yet another shock after the pandemic's over when we start to roll back these policies that were made to ease it. You know, that's a concern of mine.
Rich, what do you say to that?
Well, my hope would be that we're not creating a more statist economy that will be preserved after this crisis passes, but instead adopting temporary measures that get the most help to people most quickly. What I wonder specifically in terms of the California homeless situation, and Connor, you might not know the answer to this because it sounds like it's very much in flux, but what do they do with the schizophrenic person who is going to wander the streets regardless of whether he has a motel room or not? Is that person going to be hustled off the streets and not just not allowed to be out in public anymore one way or the other, or have they thought about that?
Most homeless people, if you go to these large encampments, which I've spent a fair amount of time in, are pretty functional. They're not completely, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are tremendous substance abuse problems and certainly some mental difficulties, but they are not people who are totally unable of taking care of themselves. So I think that, I mean, this is a whole other pre-crisis thought line, but the mental health story in homelessness has been, I think, to some degree oversold.
But I mean, and that's what you would expect in a situation like California's, right? Where the homelessness has been so exacerbated by the high prices, there should be more and more people as a percentage among the homeless whose primary driver of the homelessness is simply unaffordability. And so you would expect that, you know, more so in California than anywhere else, you're finding people who, like, really the reason they don't have a home is that homes are too expensive. And so, I mean, to Liz's point, and not just about sort of statism in responses to this, but are things that the state does now that will address the acute homelessness crisis because it's so important for a public health reason to address it right now? Are there going to be aspects of that are permanent, that provide lessons about what the state can do in the long run? Do they go at what caused the crisis in the first place?
Yeah, totally. So I think Liz's broader point, which is, if we can summon the will to solve problems that we considered unsolvable only a week or two ago, does that open people's eyes to what some amount of common purpose can accomplish? Like, if we can suddenly build a safe, relatively kind of nice, homeless neighborhood, which of course wouldn't be homeless anymore, and it's near a regular neighborhood, do the people in that kind of single-family home neighborhood or apartment neighborhood nearby, do they suddenly go, you know, I just kind of got used to those other buildings being there, and it's fine? Whereas a week ago, if someone would have proposed that, it would have been like a 6-year drawn-out fight and protests and environmental lawsuits. So I do not see how we come out of this without a very changed viewpoint about homelessness permanently. For starters, just the public health piece of this, that having a bunch of people homeless on the streets is not good for anybody's public health. I mean, you saw the same thing, by the way, this is a little miniature version of this, in San Diego. So about 2 years ago, San Diego had a really bad, you guys might remember this, but a really bad hepatitis outbreak. Tourism industry was freaking out. And, you know, within like a week, they had these giant hand washing stations throughout the city. They built three pretty big homeless shelters in the middle of downtown, right by the baseball stadium. And it was fascinating to me how once people recognized that homeless people are part of your community, they are part of your civic ecosystem, and what happens to them will affect you. You could just see the political will in San Diego for all these things just happened immediately. And I feel like that experiment we saw there is going to just be repeated across the entire state right now, because people are recognizing that this is a huge public health crisis. And I think that even after this crisis subsides, I hope they will remember that lesson.
Connor Doherty's new book is called Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor, thank you for joining us. The book is really interesting, by the way, and I'm hoping that we can have you back after this acute crisis is over to talk in, from an even broader perspective about housing in California. But for now, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
It's tempting to try to wait to have hard conversations, but from what we can tell about this crisis, people at highest risk for death are older people. And if you're a young person with parents or grandparents, now might be a good time to talk to them about their preferences for end-of-life care and what they like for their funeral arrangements. It's not something I really wanted to think about, and it was something I planned to put off for a really, really long time and to have under sort of joking conditions when I did have this conversation with my family. But considering the circumstances, it's something we should probably do now.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Bernie Sanders has an unfortunate habit of calling people he doesn't like crooks, including leaders of the pharmaceutical industry that is currently racing to try to find a way to mitigate or even solve the coronavirus crisis. If there's one lesson we should appreciate in this moment, it's the advantage of having a robust commercial pharmaceutical industry that leads the world in discovering and bringing to market new therapies. May it do so in this case as soon as possible.
For my rant, on Thursday, hours before he issued that statewide stay-at-home order, Governor Gavin Newsom released a letter to the federal government asking the Navy to send a hospital ship to the Port of Los Angeles to bolster medical treatment capacity. The letter said in part, "We project that roughly 56% of our population, 25.5 million people, will be infected with the virus over an eight-week period." Now, that is not actually the state's projection, despite what it says in Newsom's letter, and that's a good thing, because if that really were the projection, it would likely mean 2 million people needing hospitalization, a figure that would surely overrun the state's medical capacity, hospital ship or no hospital ship. The governor's office clarified to Politico, 25.5 million infections is their estimate of what would happen if the state were not engaged in mitigation measures to slow the virus spread. Of course, the state is engaged in extensive measures. The situation is still very, very bad, and the governor is right to be looking for any way to expand the state's hospital capacity. But he shouldn't be issuing dire projections that are not actually his projections. The situation we face is scary enough. There is no need to gild the lily. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Kavita Patel, and Connor Doherty. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.